KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, a pre-recorded edition with famed novelist and writer Philip Roth. We'll talk with him about his newest novel, an alternative history featuring a Charles Lindbergh presidency called The Plot Against America. And we'll explore much more with him as well about his established and highly respected body of work through the years in a never-before-aired Forum Hour after this. Philip Roth joins us for this special pre-recorded interview. We talk with him about his newest novel, an alternative history featuring a Charles Lindbergh presidency called The Plot Against America. About your work, particularly, of course, about the newest novel, The Plot Against America, which is, a counter-history like a counter-life in many ways. I'm curious to know how much the theme of history grabbed you or compelled you in this, because in many ways it seems to be locked into the whole vision in this novel.
Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't begin with a theme. I began with a fact, you know. And the fact was one I stumbled upon, very luckily as it turned out, in Arthur Schlesinger's autobiography, the first volume. And I was reading the galleys of the book in December 2000. And in writing about the 30s and 40s when Arthur was a young man, he writes about the 1940 election in which, as you know, Wendell Willkie was defeated by Franklin Roosevelt, the Democrat, and Roosevelt won a third term. But in Schlesinger's book, he talks about the fact that on the far right, the isolationist wing of the party, the Republican Party, there were those, I think like Senator Borah, who wanted Lindbergh to be the Republican candidate. That was just one sentence in the book, but it struck me because Lindbergh had been a very potent name in my house as a kid, and not just in my house, of course. And I made a little note in the margin which just said, what if they had nominated him for Republican candidate? And went on and read the book and was working on a book myself at the time. When I finished the book I was working on, I went back and looked at this line, and that's why I say I began with a fact. And I just took the fact further than reality had.
Since you mentioned beginning with a fact, I read your book, The Facts, which was an attempt to kind of set things straight in terms of facts. And here again, in this novel, you use your own family. You use the boy or the child, Philip Roth. When you do that, and you've done that in other works, you've done it in Deception, you've done it in Operation Shylock, how does the sense of grounding it in an actual historical, biographical reality of your family affect the fiction?
Well, in this book, it just was a spontaneous choice to use my family. I had my hands full, really, inventing the historical reality, or my historical unreality, as it were. And if I then had to invent a fictional family on top of that, I think I would have been drowned in the effort. So I thought to myself, okay, just change one thing. Just change Lindbergh, which is to say, just change the outcome of the 1940 election, but have everything else as it was. So it became rather like an experiment, a kind of thought experiment, which is to say, what would have happened to my family and the people in my neighborhood had Lindbergh become president? And that's to go back to what I said at the beginning, it was a spontaneous choice.
But you've done this before. Instance. You've had Kafka as your Hebrew teacher. You've had Anne Frank introduced into your fiction.
Yeah, well, it's always a spontaneous choice. You know, it's hard to account for why one chooses one form of narration over another. It's the instincts that make you a writer to begin with, and you just have to go with them, I think. And if you're any good, you will spontaneously have made the right choice.
How true to the characters of your family did you feel you needed to be in this? Because certainly you take your somewhat famous artist brother into a whole different realm. Your mother becomes almost a symbol of decorousness and of the PTA mother. Many people remember, of course, the mother in Portnoy, and they see a very different mother here. How important was it to be true, in other words, to the spirit of who your parents were and who your brother was?
Very important. That was a guiding light in writing the book. I wanted to be as accurate as I could be in presenting my family. I never really have presented my family, though people may have assumed I have. Even if I insisted otherwise, it didn't matter. But in this case, both my parents, of course, are dead. If they were living, they would be well over 100. My brother is living, and 5 years my senior. I wanted to get them as accurately as I could. I thought that was important to the whole project. I wanted to see, the reason I had to be accurate is because I wanted to see how they would behave under this pressure. And it was rather thrilling once the book got going to watch them, as it were, respond to this tremendous pressure that comes with Lindbergh's election. Pressure only on America's Jews, on no one else. And I had to ask myself as I was going along, what would he do, my father, in this situation? What would she do, my mother, in this situation? And I discovered them. So I feel that this is a very accurate picture of them, though strangely in a situation that never occurred.
Now, there's something that I think did occur. It may be apocryphal, but the story is that when you first came to San Francisco after the publication of Portnoy, and indeed many people did make this rather illusory notion of connection between your biography and that novel, which, by the way, I recently saw in a teen section in a library, you should know. I couldn't make that up. That's true. That you were asked about, or somebody actually, I think, excoriated you for the portrayal of your sister in Portnoy, who was portrayed as, Portnoy's sister is kind of a fat young woman and so forth, and you said, I find this very interesting since I don't have a sister. I don't know if that actually ever occurred, but it's sort of the truth even if it didn't occur in some ways.
I never was in San Francisco until 1992 when I met you, and so I did no book tour for Portnoy's Complaint. So it is an apocryphal story.
I'm glad to have that on the record.
Yes, now it's nailed down. I didn't have a sister. Lucky unborn girl.
Let me talk with you a bit about the child's point of view here, though, the child, Philip, which you render quite remarkably. Recently had a conversation with E.L. Doctorow about the difficulty of getting into a child's diction, let alone a child's imagination, which you inhabit here. And the fears, of course, and apprehensions and terrors of a child as well as some of the poignant inner life. Talk a little bit about how you manage that.
Well, I don't see the book as being told from the child's point of view, but rather the man is thinking through the boy's experience.
But we feel we're with that boy, and many times we're with that boy.
I hope so, yeah. Sure. But the overall, if you take the first line of the book, fear presides over these memories, a perpetual fear. This is not a boy speaking.
Right.
It's a man, and these are memories. So we have to begin with the fact that there isn't an adult intelligence at the center of the book. This adult intelligence does lead us to the boy, and to be sure, much of the situation is, as you indicate, perceived through the boy's 7, 8, 9-year-old eyes and brain. How did I do it? I used my imagination. I was helped, you know, by the fact that there isn't just one child in the book. There isn't just the little Roth kid, me. I think there are 4 children. And that was a discovery I made in writing, which is populate the book with children. Because if you have just one child, it gets rather precious. But if there's a world of children, then you see the differences between them. Then they exist, as it were, separate from the writer's tender care, you know. It also helps to write about a child when you're 71 years old and not 25. I've never written a book about with a child at the center of it. I never wanted to. It just never interested me. And I suppose I realized it would always be tremendously constraining. I prefer an adult intelligence reigning over the book. But in this case, it worked, and I think age has a lot to do with it, at least in my case, that the child isn't conceived tenderly by the writer, which is a temptation when you're young. He just exists for what he is, and in fact, he's responsible for some very tragic consequences in the book.
There is a contrast, particularly between the child Philip and the neighbor child Selden, and I was thinking, as I was reflecting on the book, that there are some other rather dramatic contrasts as well between, for example, a good rabbi and a bad rabbi, between the people who are drawn to fascism and anti-Semitism and the kind of good, decent Americans. This again evolved, or this was charted out by you, or how did this actually, I mean, take us through this a little bit.
Yeah, not charted. I was trying to make it as real as I possibly could. And my sense of reality, I'm imagining, of course, but my sense of reality led me to these choices. To go back momentarily to the children, there's the boy downstairs, Selden, who's sort of the weakest link in the chain and has a rather tragic fate. There's another boy on the street, Earl Axman, who's rather precocious, who leads little Philip on excursions through the city. They follow Gentile men, dozens of them, to see where they live. The great mystery of these Gentile men obsesses Earl Axman. There's the boy who moves in downstairs, the Italian kid, Joey, with his hearing aid and his kind of rambunctious behavior. There's my brother, who's essentially a boy. So I wasn't trying to do for a balancing act. I just was trying to create a world, you know?
Of boys.
A good rabbi, of boys. And then we get to the, if you want to speak of the rabbis, Rabbi Bengelsdorf, who's a kind of star in the book, was for me a most interesting character. Because he's been rather harshly judged, in, I think, by people. Maybe they think I judge him harshly. What he says is not without its sense in the book. His problem is that he's on the wrong side. But the problem in politics is you don't know if you're on the wrong side or not. Then there's yet another rabbi who is rather heroic, Rabbi Prince, who actually existed. And I wasn't trying to balance things as much as to create a full world, you know.
So Bengelsdorf reminded me a bit of a character named Baruch Korf, who was known as Nixon's rabbi. And in the past, you have been, I don't know if harsh is the right word, but you've certainly been critical of rabbis. I remember saying a phrase from one of your books where you talked about a rabbi who couldn't say God without using three syllables. And there's something rather pretentious about Rabbi Bengelsdorf as well, isn't there?
Well, to go back to what you said to begin with, I don't think that first rabbi who couldn't say God without saying three syllables, I think exists in Portnoy's Complaint, a book I wrote in 1960, or was published in 1969, which is now 35 years ago, about. And I don't think I've had a rabbi in a book for 35 years. I've let them go for 35 years. So it's not something I'm really terribly concerned with, you know. But Bengelsdorf is of importance because this is a significant choice for someone, a rabbi like this man, which is, what do we do? Lindbergh's in power. Do we just accede to the anti-Semitism, which we expect, or do I go in there and try to educate the man, which is what Bengelsdorf says he does? So he is a bit more complicated, I think, than people have perceived him to be. He also is very friendly with Lindbergh's wife, Anne Morrow Lindbergh, again in my book, or the Anne Morrow Lindbergh in my book, and educates her, as it were, about Jews. And then Anne Morrow Lindbergh turns out really to be the heroine of the book, or at least the political heroine, mm-hmm. you know. So Bengelsdorf has his influence. In the end, he writes a book called My Life Under Lindbergh, which is a big bestseller, I think I say, in 1946 or something, I forget, 45. And it's taken to be an apologia for his involvement or collaboration with the Lindbergh administration. And he, in the book, he spells out his notion of what the kidnapping of the Lindbergh child was all about, et cetera, et cetera. I won't go into it, but it's a rather a loony vision. And though read by some readers as though it's my vision, that I'm announcing this in the book, but it's very much the character's vision. So Bengelsdorf is not just someone who is made light of or satirized, not at all.
No, I grant you, he's a multidimensional character, to be sure. It's just that it's easy to dislike him because he and Aunt Evelyn, whom he marries, well, they relish their role. They take it up with gusto, and I suppose you might be satirizing, to some extent, that desire of Jews to be insiders.
Well, don't generalize too much. I don't know about Jews. I know about Aunt Evelyn. I know about Rabbi Bengelsdorf.
All right. Well said. You also, well, that brings up actually another question. When you talk about Earl Axman and following Christians home like an adventure, and we start out in Union, New Jersey, in the sense of Jews not belonging there, the feeling from Hermann Roth, the father, that there's a Bund meeting after all, the orphanage that you give us in the novel. In other words, there is a sense that even though the Lindbergh administration wants to take people out of the ghetto, that maybe the people want to remain in the ghetto?
Well, I think there is a certain ambiguity surrounding the Lindbergh proposal to transfer Jews to other parts of the country. The problem is that it should be voluntary. So that's, again, if we go back to Rabbi Bengelsdorf, everything he says is okay, but he's on the wrong side. And this notion of taking Jews and moving them out is reprehensible only if it's involuntary. If it's suggested to people that if you want to, we'll pay your way to Kentucky, and you say, I don't want to, that's fine. But if you say, you're going to Kentucky and we're paying your way, that's something else. So I don't know that ghetto, of course, has a pejorative connotation now. And I don't know that it's a neighborhood. It's a Jewish neighborhood, I think, is a more accurate way of describing it. In the middle of this Jewish neighborhood, to be sure, there is this Catholic orphanage, which is quite strange and anomalous. And just to introduce a personal anecdote, just yesterday I received a wonderful 4-page letter from a man I never knew, though we went to grade school together and high school together, but he was a couple years behind me. And he wrote the letter to me because of he and his wife had read The Plot Against America and then took a trip over to Newark, apparently his first since he was a kid, and he showed his wife around and so on, and drove by the old orphanage grounds and had his own experiences at the orphanage. All of us were a bit transfixed by that orphanage, because where would we ever see nuns and priests and Catholic kids like that, especially in an orphanage which had its own thrilling and frightening dimension, you know.
Exoticism almost, yeah?
Yes, quite exotic. Exotic, and there was a frightening side to it. But I remember being drawn to the fence of the orphanage often as a kid and looking inside and wondering what it was, you know. I would have run like hell if anybody said, come on over and join us.
We're talking with Philip Roth. His newest book is The Plot Against America. And there's a sense for me as a reader, and I wonder from your point of view how important it was, that there seems to be, you know, when you mentioned about Jews before and Jews wanting recognition on the inside and said, well, I wouldn't categorize it as Jews. I certainly understood your point of view, but I also have a point of view as a reader that you want to emphasize the ordinariness of Jews here. The fact that, you know, they were really ordinary patriotic Americans, continue to be, of course, ordinary patriotic Americans doing all kinds of different sorts of labor and so forth. And that comes across pretty strongly.
To be sure, but once again, I would say the key word is reality. I wanted to represent what was, as I remember it. And I had no polemical or didactic intent. I just wanted to represent these people I grew up with. When I was a child, they were adults. As they were, as a child might perceive them as well, but what did they do? And yes, they of course they performed ordinary activities. Let me refer once again to this fellow whose name is George Dickstein, who wrote me this letter. When he said about our neighborhood that he explains to his friends who grew up in New York City, it was totally unlike growing up in New York City or a Jewish neighborhood in New York City, that the neighborhood had a small town cozy feeling. And it's exactly true. And there was a difference when you crossed the Passaic River and the Hackensack River and the Hudson River and got to New York, life was very different. But west of the Passaic, which is where Newark sits, you're in America.
You're talking about the realism and the importance of realism in this novel. And in fact, I'm not going to spoil anything with the plot, but even the real lynching of Leo Frank comes in at the end of the novel. And you have somebody like Paul Berman in the New York Review of Books who says that what you're really doing here in many ways is mythologizing your own past, writing about survivorship and fascism and anti-Semitism and doing perhaps what you did in the Shylock operation when you had the character Philip Roth involved in all kinds of secret Mideast intrigue, that's a way of mythologizing your own past.
I don't know what that means.
Well, I'm not sure I do either, which is why I guess I'm raising it with you. I think he's...
can't help you.
Yeah, all right. Well, then we'll go on to something else.
I don't know what that means. And the fact that neither of us knows what it means tells us something.
Well, I want to go back actually to what we had said, or what I brought up earlier about the sense of history here. I'm really reminded of, this may seem a stretch to you, Berman was talking about Sinclair Lewis's It Can't Happen Here and other work, Michael Gold's Jews Without Money, and there's a lot of intertextuality, including your own work, but what I'm reminded of most prominently in many ways in reading this book is Joyce and Faulkner, and particularly the sense of history as a nightmare, or Faulkner and Absalom making us aware of history as this kind of giant crapshoot.
Well, I love Absalom, but the density of Absalom puts it in another category, also the greatness, puts it in another category of book entirely. But I think your sense, what you're saying about the place that history plays in Faulkner, yes, I respond to that. And when you were speaking of Joyce, I thought momentarily you were going to speak about some of the short stories or even the beginning of Portrait of the Artist, where he does have a boy's sense of the world. Since you bring up Sinclair Lewis, I was totally unfamiliar with the book It Can't Happen Here, other than the title, and I find Sinclair Lewis quite unreadable.
Well, I was just going to say, the Joyce connection also comes to me with Araby, with the boy's point of view from the standpoint of memory and adulthood.
Exactly. I hadn't thought of Araby for years until you just mentioned it's a wonderful story.
It is indeed, and we are coming up on a break here. We're talking with Philip Roth. His book is The Plot Against America. We will continue, and stay with us. This is a special pre-recorded edition of Forum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking in this special pre-recorded edition of the program with Philip Roth. His newest novel is The Plot Against America. And we were talking before we went to that break, about Faulkner and Joyce. I must confess to you that with this work and with much of your work, but particularly with this work in some ways, there's an extra kind of poignancy here that parallels my response to Faulkner as a reader, and that is the loss of childhood.
Let me
elaborate a little bit. I mean, you know, I kept thinking about the adult again, writing about this and trying to recreate it, but also having all of this childhood memory to somehow orchestrate and work through. and the poignancy of some of those memories. I mean, just something like the stamp collection and how important the stamp collection can be to childhood and to a young boy growing up in curiosity and with an emotional life that's awakening and so forth. And the adult perspective or the perch of adulthood gives us a real feeling of loss.
Well, I think poignancy is a good word to use in speaking about this boy from an adult point of view. You speak of the stamp collection. I'm glad you did. It was very important to me to get that right for a variety of reasons, and not just because I had a stamp collection that meant a great deal to me as a child. But nine-tenths of the boy's knowledge of the world is through his stamps. And the stamps give him an image of a kind of patriot's America. And you spoke earlier of contrasts. Here, indeed, I did want a contrast between the boy's sense of a patriot's America and what's going on around him. And I think all of his innocence finds expression in his relationship to the stamp album, which eventually he loses when he attempts to run away from home and run away because he feels his family is going under in the face of Lindbergh's presence. And he wants to run away to the Catholic orphanage.
I wasn't going to give that away, but you did.
Well, that's okay. It's, let's give some things away free. And he runs away to the Catholic orphanage, and in leaving, he just can't leave without his stamp collection. He can't give that up. And so he takes it with him, and he runs away at night, and he has a terrible accident when he gets within the orphanage grounds, and he's hospitalized as a result of the accident. And when he's taken home, he realizes his stamp collection is gone. And there's a terrifying scene for him when he says to his mother, it's gone, and she goes to look for it, and it's just simply disappeared. I was thinking of a line of Chekhov's. I'm going to get it wrong, and some of your listeners will know it better than I do, but Chekhov says if a pistol is hanging on the wall in the first act, it has to go off in the third act. And the same thing with the stamp collection. If a boy has a stamp collection he loves greatly in the first half of the book, in a book like this or in a book by me, I don't know which it is, then something terrible has to happen to that stamp collection.
Well, stamps become an important metaphor, though, and that's right on the cover because of a dream the boy has. But also, if stamps are an important metaphor, so are stumps. I'm not trying to be clever here, but I don't think I am. But what drew you to that whole notion of an amputee? And again, I don't want to give away the plot here, but the stump is really centrally of central importance, is it not?
Yeah. I'll, if you don't want to give it away, I'll give it away. They have a cousin, the Roth family, the Roth boys, rather, myself and my brother, an older cousin, Alvin, who's rather engaging because he's flamboyant and tough and so on. And when Lindbergh gets elected, runs away to Canada to fight with the Canadian Army against Hitler in Europe. And he's a commando, and almost immediately that he enters the war, he gets badly injured and he loses half of his left leg, I think, below the knee. And he comes back and lives with us. Now, this never happened. This is a total invention.
No cousin Alvin?
There's no cousin Alvin. Okay. If there was, he'd be coming after me now.
Yeah, and Evelyn, too, would be coming after you.
Doesn't exist. The book needed these people. Think about it. You know, if you have a sort of decent family at the core, mother, father, two sons who are fundamentally good kids, it's boring as hell. And it's partly why I never was able to write directly about my family before. I knew they were too responsible. They were too hardworking. They were too predictable to be interesting. And my brother and I were just sort of good boys. But I could finally use this family if tremendous pressure was brought to bear on them. Now, I didn't know this when I started the book. I didn't know what I was going to do, and I didn't know what I'd come up with. But what I discovered is, and maybe lots of other writers know this and knew it before me, which is if you bring great pressure on very ordinary people, then you get conduct which is interesting to observe. Well, great pressure is brought on them when Alvin comes back with a prosthetic leg and sleeps in the same room next to little Philip. And the little boy becomes the caretaker, as it were, of his cousin's stump, which is repellent to him, terrifies him, frightens him as much as anything. And yet he comes to take care of it. And it's very strong medicine. But I wanted the little boy to be up against strong medicine. That's how I got out of that business of there just being good kids, you see.
There's even a violent scene with Alvin and the father. I mean, to imagine a character as decent as Herman Roth and to some extent as pacific as he is, although he certainly has angry emotions in response to Lindbergh and the Nazis, mm-hmm. to put it mildly, mm-hmm. in this violent scene with his nephew, that must have been quite an act of your own imagination, as so much of this is.
Well, there is violence in the house, and there was no violence in our house at all. I don't think my brother was ever struck, and I was never struck, and just wasn't in the ethos of the house, as it wasn't in most of the houses around us either. A book is something else, and this crisis is something else. We, after all, never lived through a crisis like this. And a friend of mine who did live through a crisis like this, who is a European survivor, said to me, "You're right, this is what happens. People go nuts, and they start to turn on each other." And that's what happens in that scene that you speak of. There's also violence in as much as my mother strikes my brother twice in succession after he disobeys my father, and not about an ordinary issue, about something having to do with Lindbergh. And then little Roth sneaks off to the Newsreel Theater to see some things about the Nazis and comes home, when he comes out of the theater, struck by his father. So yes, there is violence of a kind I didn't know in my own childhood. But it's irrelevant whether I knew it or not. What's relevant is that in this situation, under this kind of pressure, I believe these kind of things happen.
You mentioned young Philip Roth going into the theater, and there's a mention of the virility associated with the theater. In fact, you talk at one point about, or the narrative voice talks about, the ardor of the men, which is seen as pushiness by the Gentiles. And mm-hmm. and there's a sense that a lot of these men are ambitious. They are, I suppose, what Tom Brokaw would have called, you know, the great generation men, and that they have an enlivening and almost I hesitate to use the word, but spiritual sense of vitality to them, whether they're bosses or whether they're men who are overrun like the father is, or whether they're the gangsters that also appear in the novel. They're men of ardor.
Well, that's an interesting observation when you say they're men of vitality, and that is true. That does come out of my own background. The men were largely undereducated. They were largely the children of immigrants, and in a city like Newark, two-thirds of the, back in, say, 1910, 1915, before World War I, two-thirds of the children of immigrants didn't go beyond the eighth grade. That was just the standard. And I don't think it was only in the city of Newark. Nonetheless, around me, I felt a tremendous vitality from the men, whether the guy was a plumber or had a soda water franchise or was whatever, you know. That characterized the neighborhood, that vitality. They were hardly broken men. And in my book, you begin with Alvin and his tremendous vitality. You can speak of the guy he works for. What the hell is his name?
Schrellemann or something?
No,
Sturman.
Steinheim? Is that his name?
Well,
something like
close
that.
Close enough. Yeah.
You wrote the book, Michael. You should know. I think his name is Steiner, who's quite a character. You know, I didn't want to have nice Jews and have a book about anti-Semitism, and there are these victims who are these nice Jews. I wanted to have real Jews. and the kind of Jews that I knew, and guys, businessmen, the uncle, for instance, Uncle Monty, who was interested in only one thing, his business. And at one point near the end of the book, I think I say that my, vis-a-vis Lindbergh, my father chose resistance, Rabbi Bengelsdorf chose collaboration, and Uncle Monty chose himself. And there were lots of men who would, in that situation, have chosen themselves. Let's just get on with the business, you know.
It's probably too easy to call Lonnie Zwillman the Jewish Tony Soprano of his day, but I'm just curious. Did you know of or have any contact with Lonnie Zwillman?
Longie Zwillman.
Jewish gangster, no, I should mention.
Thank goodness, no. First of all, he was my father's generation. But he was, his name was pervasive. You heard about him. One of his closest associates had a daughter who was in my class, and she was just somebody I sort of stayed away from in high school. You didn't want to date a mobster's daughter, I don't think. Look, this is the era of the great racketeers. They came into business with Prohibition, and Longie Zwillman was one of them, and he ran bootlegging in New Jersey, and eventually came to the top because he was the toughest, command the most respect. And then he went into all kinds of related racketeering, having to do with the docks in Newark and transportation, garbage collection, so on and so on. But he was there, and he was pretty big. So he was. I mean, he was in that group with Meyer Lansky. Meyer Lansky was, of course, the king, but he was pretty close to that. I never met the man. I saw him once in my life during the Kefauver hearings on television back in the 50s. And Longie was interrogated by the Kefauver committee, and then 6 months later he hanged himself.
But you bring him in here in again, a realistic way, as you do so much of the historical milieu, including all that was pervasive in anti-Semitism, the Bund, the KKK, Father Coughlin, Gerald L.K. Smith, and so forth. And you feel like, as a reader, that you are indeed entering into a real history, despite the fact that you know it's an alternative, imagined, and fictional history. And, for example, there's a Kristallnacht scene in the novel, and I found myself believing in that Kristallnacht scene.
Good.
I mean, that is indeed the realism that shines through, isn't it?
Well, that's what I was hoping for, you know? Blessedly, nothing like this ever happened in America. That's quite wonderful.
Yeah, pregnant pause there, and appropriately so. Despite your realism and your devotedness to it, do you find yourself in some ways maybe getting a little bit nostalgic as a septuagenarian? I mean, after all, the ordinary common virtues that come through here, the feeling about family. Some might say, you know, this has nothing to do with the younger Roth.
Do I feel nostalgic for the past?
For childhood,
I
too.
I love things that were that I knew in my childhood, and I still do. But I don't long for them or try to recreate them. Writers think about the past and maybe their own past in a more in a deeper and perhaps more devoted way because of the necessities of the job than ordinary people may do. Not that I mean that ordinary people don't think about their childhoods in the past, but not in the same sustained way. But I don't think about it with nostalgia. I tried, certainly when I'm at work, to think about it so that I can render it as accurately as possible with all its dimensions.
When you are rendering it, are you there? I know it sounds a little bit like a corny question, but I mean,
no.
Do you occupy it?
Yes and no. The no is a strong no, in as much as I'm struggling to write the goddamn sentence. But yes, in another way, which is I have to remember or pretend to remember. For instance, in the writing of this book, I early on came upon a kind of slogan for myself that was extremely helpful. I wasn't keen on writing this book when I began it for a variety of reasons. One was the child, and there were other reasons too. It was a straightforward narrative and so on. And I said to myself, don't invent, just remember. But by that I meant the Lindbergh administration. I meant, you're going to go nuts if you try to invent this. But if you just sit here and remember what happened, just calm down and remember what happened. Tell me what happened. Okay, here's what happened. So the way you might tell a story to a child to put the child to sleep, where you get the child to believe it happened, then you almost believe it happened, though frogs don't talk, you know. But I did try to remember what had happened for those 2 years we had lived under Lindbergh.
And because fear hovers over this story so much, and because there is violence in it, as you say, I wonder if you're remembering and you're also creating at the same time, how calm you can be when you're writing some of that material.
Pretty calm. I don't break into a sweat. It's exciting when something comes out. You know, you've got a paragraph and it's in English, and you know, you're excited at the end of the day if what you did was good and you know where you're going to go the next day, but not ecstatic. And only at the end is there kind of the ecstasy of relief, which is I did it. I never want to do it again.
On to the next project.
Yeah, alas.
Talking to Philip Roth, his new book is The Plot Against America. We have limited time with you. I just needed to ask maybe a couple of quick questions. One is, there's been so much attempt to make an analogy between this novel and what's going on now under the Bush administration, and you've pretty much expressed yourself on these parallels and said, you know, that was not your intention and so forth. But you did make a statement in print about comparing our president to a man unfit to run a hardware store, let alone a nation like this one. What's been the result of that rather strong statement?
I think what happened, I said he was unfit to... I said something that Aristophanes, who surely must be God, has given us George Bush, a man unfit to run a hardware store, let alone a nation like ours. The result, I understand, I didn't see it, was that there was an angry letter from the hardware store owners of America. it's one of the angry letters that wasn't passed on to me. I don't know what to say to them except, fellas, I meant you no harm, you know.
That's been the main negative response that you've received from the coalition of hardware store owners?
Well, yeah, alas, it didn't seem to affect the election, so...
Alas, what about the effect of this novel with respect to the rise of global anti-Semitism? I mean, any connections or important kind of links in your mind?
No, I mean, I know about it, and I have a very good French friend, a rather distinguished French critic named Alan Finkielkraut, who talks to me about it. But the 30s were a very bad time as well, you know, and anti-Semitism was a general Western phenomenon in the 1930s, and not just restricted to Europe. And we had it here. And Ford and Lindbergh, two of the most famous Americans living, were themselves strong and vocal anti-Semites. And that's what interested me. I really saw for the first time, maybe, how strongly conscious as a kid I was of the anti-Semitic static. It wasn't in our neighborhood, it wasn't in our school. I never felt the lash ever in my life. Not in college, nowhere did I ever encounter directly to my face anti-Semitism. What people said after I walked by, I don't know. But in the 30s, even a kid, even a little kid, and I was born in 33, even a little kid was conscious that there was something out there called anti-Semitism that was our enemy, that wanted to exclude us or do us harm for reasons not even a child could, no child could figure out, and who could figure it out anyway? It's an irrational disease. And Father Colgan, who you mentioned earlier, the priest, the anti-Semitic priest from Detroit who had a Sunday radio program, my father would turn on that program on Sunday just to get his blood boiling. But it wasn't just to do that. He lived in the world he lived in. He wanted to know what was happening. But Colgan had tremendous influence. Yes, the German-American Bund, which had been inspired really by the Nazis, had quite a few meeting places and headquarters in New Jersey. And they had a big summer camp in New Jersey out in Sussex County. I was very conscious, if not with the specifics, I was still conscious that they were there. So I didn't realize that as much as I do now until I put the book together. Now, I would just repeat, Lindbergh never was president of the United States. The Nazis had Hitler and we had FDR. None of this did happen. And so you might ask, then why the hell did you write the book? And I don't know.
You don't need to know, do you?
Well, I don't. Maybe I don't need to, but maybe I need to. But the fact is, I don't know.
Did you, as a boy, listen to Walter Winchell?
Oh, you couldn't miss him. He was coming out of every house on the street. It was 15 minutes on Sunday evening at 9 o'clock. And Sunday evenings were a great night for the radio because it had all the comedy shows before Winchell, so you were just glued to the radio. And then at 9 on came Winchell, and he was quite a dramatic personality. And I tried to imitate him in the book. And then I recently, on some program that I was on, they played some, to shame me, I think, they played some Winchell. And I thought, oh, my goodness, he's much better than I am. And he was a very compelling radio personality.
Well, you've given him new life here. Just a quick question about FDR, because he was such an icon to so many Jews. Arthur Clarke wrote a book, While 6 Million Died. There's been a lot of historical analysis of FDR as perhaps not being as heroic where the Jews were concerned. Your thoughts about that, just to conclude here?
Well, none of us knew that. In the period I'm writing about, which is the late 30s and early 40s, Roosevelt was, as you say, a heroic figure to the Jews. The Democratic Party shouldn't be left out either. Roosevelt had identified the Democratic Party with the underprivileged, with minorities. The coalition that kept him in office included Jews and those blacks who were able to vote at that time, labor unions, and so on. So that these are the people who were locked out of the Republican Party. And the Jews felt they had a place in Roosevelt's Democratic Party. And they were not wrong, by the way.
Actually, one final question, if you'll indulge me. Were you happy with the films that were made of your work, Goodbye Columbus, Portnoy's Complaint, The Human Stain, on the whole? Or did you have serious reservations of your narrative art being turned into cinema?
The movies. let's not talk about that.
All right, we won't if you don't want to. In fact, that's the whole subtext in itself, I think. It's been delightful to have you here, and I'm most appreciative for the time. And again, the book, Philip Roth's book, one of our most distinguished novelists, not only here in the United States, but an internationally bestseller author, is The Plot Against America. We won't talk about the movies, but have they approached you yet about this?
My literary agent has been instructed not to accept any or even indulge any offers.
All right. Again, that says volumes. So pleased to have had you with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
I'm Michael Krasny. That was a pre-recorded interview we did with Philip Roth, one of our nation's most distinguished novelists and an internationally best-selling author. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 1997 for American Pastoral and published four other works in the 90s, Patrimony, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award, Operation Shylock, which won the Penn Faulkner Award, Sabbath's Theater, which won the National Book Award, and I Married a Communist, which won the Ambassador Book Award of the English-Speaking Union. Previously, he won the National Book Critics Circle Award for The Counterlife in 1986 and the National Book Award for Goodbye Columbus in 1959. In the year 2000, he published The Human Stain, which became a major motion picture, and in 1998, he received the National Medal of Arts at the White House, and in 2002 was awarded the Gold Medal in Fiction from the Academy of Arts and Letters. Next year, Philip Roth becomes the third living American writer to have his work published in a comprehensive edition by the Library of America, the last of the eight volumes scheduled to be published in 2013. The most recent novel, which we spoke about in this pre-recorded interview, The Plot Against America, is about a young boy, an ardent stamp collector named Philip Roth, a member of a family with the identical names of Roth's actual New Jersey family, and the observations about the effects of his family and beyond of a Charles Lindbergh presidency in this alternate version of American history. We see the pro-Nazi, isolationist, and anti-Semitic aviation hero defeat Franklin D. Roosevelt for the presidency when Roosevelt ran for a third term, and history for the Roth family and for America takes another course and proceeds in far different channels. I thought, well, we had a little bit of time after the interview was over that I would read the opening page of The Plot Against America by Philip Roth, just to give you a flavor. Fear presides over these memories, a perpetual fear. Of course, no childhood is without its terrors, yet I wonder if I would have been a less frightened boy if Lindbergh hadn't been president or if I hadn't been the offspring of Jews. When the first shock came in June of 1940, the nomination for the presidency of Charles A. Lindbergh, America's international aviation hero, by the Republican convention at Philadelphia, my father was 39, an insurance agent with a grade school education, earning a little under $50 a week, enough for the basic bills to be paid on time, but for little more. My mother, who'd wanted to go to teacher's college but couldn't because of the expense, who'd lived at home working as an office secretary after finishing school, who'd kept us from feeling poor during the worst of the Depression by budgeting the earnings of my father, turned over to her each Friday as efficiently as she ran the household, was 36.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.